Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in consolidated arguments of Thomas v. Oldham and Gibson v. Spence.
May it please the court, parties in this cause have agreed to divide their time equally, each speaking for 10 minutes. Ms. Andrea Chan will present argument first.
Good morning, my name is Andrea Chan. I'm representing the City of Houston and Officer Hal Oldham in this appeal. For clarification purposes, I guess I would be considered the petitioner as to Officer Oldham of the City's cross appeal regarding damages, but would be considered the respondent involving the 101.106 argument that's before the court and consolidated with the Gibson matter. Basically, the facts in the case were that there was a car accident involving Officer Oldham and Ms. Thomas, which resulted in a judgment of $500,000 taken against the defendants. The Court of Appeals limited the judgment to $250,000 based on the Capital Tort Claims Act, reversing that part of the judgment from the trial court, which assessed another $459,000.
Speak up a little bit louder, please.
Certainly. Against the officer individually. I guess what's most important before this court is the application of 101.106 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which reads, a judgment in an action or settlement of a claim under this chapter bars any action involving the same subject matter by the claimant against the employee of the governmental unit whose act or omission gave rise to this claim. In this case, we have a suit which involves both the governmental entity and the employee. The conclusion of the suit, both claims were adjudicated, and the Court of Appeals held that that was a claim that would bar any subsequent claim against the employee, thereby reducing the award to the plaintiff and limiting it to just the $250,000 provided by the Texas Tort Claims Act. Interestingly, the Dallas Court of Appeals has also followed this and has held that 101.106 bars a subsequent judgment against an individual employee in a suit brought concurrently against the governmental unit and the employee. Now, I think Texas law is quite clear that if a lawsuit is brought against a governmental employee and the statute has not run, the plaintiff may bring another lawsuit against the governmental entity. I think the law is very clear in the state also that if there has been a lawsuit that was just against a governmental entity and there was an adjudication, that there can be no suit brought against the employee. Now, we've gotten into a little bit of a fuzzy area when we look at lawsuits that are brought against the governmental entity and the employee at the same time. If you look at some of the cases that have come down, you'll remember that in a case where there's been summary judgment against the plaintiff in favor of the governmental entity, that would bar any subsequent action against the employee if the action arose out of the Tort Claims Act. And that would be the case of Cox versus Club. In that case, a lawsuit was brought against a medical center and its employee, the doctor. For whatever reason, the notice provisions under the Texas Tort Claims Act were not complied with, and the court dismissed the action against the hospital. And then later held that in that same action, judgment could not be brought against the employee either because it arose both actions arose out of the Texas Tort Claims Act. And that would be a case where there were two concurrent judgments. And one would bar the action against the employee. I think the opponents on this case have argued that under a mandamus action in the City of Bedford versus Shatman, that the court's treatment of discovery of the existence of insurance on the part of the individual employee allows recovery against the employee. However, I think that case can be distinct because, first of all, in a footnote, the court admitted that any settlement by a plaintiff with a governmental unit would release all claims against the governmental unit's employees. And secondly, because that was a specific case dealing with discovery issues, very limited, didn't have anything to do with the merits of the case, but whether or not discovery could be allowed in that case, that it would be inapplicable to the situation we have here involving the actual judgment.
Well, what basis would there be for discovering the individual employee's insurance policy if there were no liability for the employee?
Well, you could have a case where a lawsuit might have been brought against, say, a police officer for what might have been an intentional tort. In that case, 101.057 of the Texas Tort Claims Act would preclude any action against the governmental entity. However, it would be relevant to that action that would remain against the governmental employee.
Is it your position that the law of Texas is that a governmental employee is immunized for any non-intentional conduct committed during the course of employment except to the extent of the Tort Claims Act cap liability?
I think that if the governmental entity is not involved in the lawsuit, that it's not an action brought under the Texas Tort Claims Act. And therefore, a plaintiff could obtain a judgment against an individual employee sued individually without any governmental entity involved, and he could recover whatever amount the jury would award him.
So you're put to kind of an election of remedies that you wouldn't face against a private employer?
To an extent, I think that the whole focus of this is the fact that the Tort Claims Act is providing an additional remedy. It's not limiting anything, but providing an additional remedy. That is a remedy against a governmental unit. I think it's so difficult to get a lot of people to work for governmental entities that they have this fear that they're going to be subject to liability for whatever reason.
So is it your contention then that in any action where both the governmental employee and the government are sued, that the employee's liability is always limited to the extent of the governmental liability under the Tort Claims Act?
If the governmental unit is also brought into
yes.
the lawsuit, yes.
So that governmental employee, for example, who is drunk and goes out and causes death on the highways, the most that governmental employee can be responsible for is the limit of the governmental unit's liability.
Assuming that it has
occurs
been
during the
course and scope,
course
of,
scope of employment.
Yes.
What public policy do you see served by limiting the liability of individuals in that situation when their liability would not be so limited if they work for a private employer?
I think the whole notion of public service and working for governmental units outweighs that. You have the whole concept of official immunity, which is based on that whole same public policy argument, that we don't want our public employees to feel the fear of having liability suits against them for whatever they might do.
Basically, our need for public employees is so great that it is essential to insulate them even from their gross negligence.
Sure. I think it's very difficult to find people, say, to drive garbage trucks for the governmental unit, and that they need whatever encouragement they can to get to be part of that. We need those employees to be part of our system, and the act further would say that, you know, how would you collect on the judgment?
So if we have a drunk garbage truck driver, the most that drunk garbage truck driver can be sued for in a suit against where the municipality is also involved is the limit of the municipality's liability under the Tort Claims Act, no matter how much mayhem may have been caused by that drunk driver.
That's correct, because if he had not been employed by that governmental unit, he would not have been in that accident.
Okay.
You're saying that the underlying purpose of the limitation in the Tort Claims Act is to not to necessarily to limit the liability of the governmental entity, but to limit the recovery of the injured party?
On behalf, because he is working on behalf of the governmental unit. Of course, if it's someone who's not in the course and scope or for whatever reason, it's an intentional tort, and it's found that the governmental unit cannot be liable under the theory of responding to superior, then your governmental employee would still be liable.
And you say to those who are injured and cannot be fully compensated that this is just the price of public service?
Just like the price of driving down a public street. The Texas Tort Claims Act has limited that too. Even if you were to allow a recovery like that, 101.106 would bar any type of action to recover beyond that. How would you enforce a judgment? You couldn't file a writ of execution because that would be a new lawsuit that involves the same subject matter.
Do you have any sites for the position that an execution is an action under this statute?
I'm sorry, could you?
Do you have any authority for the assertion that a writ of execution would be an action under 101.106?
I don't have any other than that it is a new lawsuit. And that would be another action.
Ken, I was going to ask, it seems to me that you could argue that if you sue the employee and the city at the same time and you come to a verdict that shows the city is liable, that you could argue that that comports with a statute that says a judgment or settlement precludes a judgment against the employee. But suppose you have exactly the same facts and the plaintiff only sues the employee. Taking some of your argument to its logical extension, the reason that the employee may remain liable is because you might not have any action against the city, but only against the employee individually. But if you reverse the order and you try against the employee and get a judgment against the employee, that does not preclude you from subsequently suing the city.
And that's correct? What the case law has held. That's all.
And so what, under that interpretation, could not a plaintiff sue the employee, get a judgment, collect on the judgment, then sue the city?
Sure, and I think that's happening now. Or they're reaching a settlement with an employee, and then they come back and sue the government.
Now, does that mean if they get a collection against the city, they must reimburse? Does the employee have some sort of cause of action for reimbursement at that point?
The governmental entity, or the governmental employee probably could even bring in the governmental entity as a third party for contribution and indemnity. And it could be part of the same lawsuit. That would be the...
But I'm assuming the hypothetical is they are not. The employee just sued standing alone, loses, and the judgment gets paid from their own personal insurance, I suppose. The logic of saying the judgment doesn't really mean judgment. Settlement doesn't mean settlement. Just means liability allows a plaintiff to do indirectly what they can't do directly, which is they can go against the employee separately, without including the city, and collect on the judgment, and then still go against the city and collect on the judgment. There's nothing in this statute that would preclude that.
Other than the statute of limitations.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ken.
May it please the court. Mr. James Brannan will present argument today.
May it please the court. I want to pick up with your question, Your Honor, about any authority for the notion that once you have a judgment, that anything after that constitutes an action under this statute. I don't believe there is a case, we can't find one anywhere that says such a thing. The statute uses the word action twice. Judgment in an action or a settlement of a claim bars any action involving the same subject matter. We believe that action means lawsuit, and a lawsuit that terminates in a judgment and then you have to execute it or they pay off does not constitute some additional thing that would then be barred by the by the meaning of this statute. That suggestion was made, incidentally, in the amicus brief, in the footnote, where they say, well, that means if you have a contemporaneous case and you have the judgment against the individual and against the city or government unit, that wouldn't do you any good because anything you did past that would constitute an action. But they didn't cite any authority for that proposition. I don't think there is. I want to take issue, I'm not sure it's taking issue or not, because I don't think the position of the city in the brief in this case matches up with what we've heard today. That is to say, I don't believe that the city takes a position that in the third situation, what I call the third situation, you have three situations. You sue the government, and then you sue the individual, and that's barred. That's the clear language of the statute. You sue them at the same time. That's what we're here about today. Or you sue the individual, then the government. I don't believe they take the position in the brief that you can't do position number three, that you can't sue the individual and then sue.
And you can recover against the individual in excess of the statutory cap and collect that judgment.
Absolutely. That's a different lawsuit. It's not governed by the limitation. Under the Tort Claims Act.
Let's move on to some
of the that's well established. The Driscoll case, this court was unanimous in 1990 talking about that point. So, to get to the issue of that middle ground here, what happens if you file a contemporaneous? Well, number one, the cases involve concurrent lawsuits. Everybody's always filed concurrently. For example, the Aber case is situation three, where they filed it concurrently, but just before the jury, they submitted it to the jury, they settled with the individual. So you can conceptually say, well, that's a different lawsuit then. They took that step, even though the individuals brought into the case, discovery, trial, everything, and they settled with them just before then.
You cite a number of cases where they have sued both, and it's gone all the way, in fact, up to this court in at least two.
Yes,
But in fact, this point of error has never been presented to us. And we'll pass for a minute whether it's been waived here. But in the Madisonville case,
the point
nobody ever brought this up. And in the Bus case, we chose to write it in Hopkins. We wrote about some other thing without ever directly addressing this point, which wasn't written.
Oh, I agree, Your Honor. I don't believe I could pull out any language where this court specifically resolved. I mean, that's why we have three courts of civil appeals on one side of this issue and one court of civil, I'm showing my age here. One court of appeals on one side and three courts on the other. That's what this court, as I understand it, has to resolve. I mean, that's my interpretation why he granted both writs in the case, to resolve that one point.
So despite what the briefs might say, this is an open question for the court to resolve.
Oh, I'm not here to say, I don't have, yes, I think it must be, yes. I cannot say the court has, I believe that you can infer, I mean, it's like everything else, when we brief it below, we brief these cases because there isn't such a decision. And so we try to draw what lessons we can from Kyle and from the others. They said, well, you know, they raised it on a point of error, and you granted the writ in the low case, and you wrote on it, but you didn't mention that, so we think that means you felt that was okay, but I'm not here to say you did say that. No, sir. I believe the issue could have been decided specifically in any of these cases. It has not been. But I believe, in terms of being a lawyer and trying to figure out what you want to do for your client, you try to read where you think the law is, even without a pronouncement of the Supreme Court specifically on the point. So I don't have any feeling it's been decided the other way either, in other words, Your Honor. So it seems to me then that we need to think about the scenario of the concurrent case that now goes all the way and you've prepared the charge, and if you don't settle with the individual, that point, if you don't settle with him, you're going to be out when the jury writes down the answers, because you're going to have then a final judgment against the government, and it's going to trigger, it'll be the trigger to this 101-106. Well, so what do you do if that's the rule? Then you, number one, you eliminate the concurrent suit. You got to have two lawsuits then. You don't want to ever take the chance, unless you can say, and you know, if you talk about putting a thread through an eye of a needle, you could say that if the judgment, say you have that situation, concurrent lawsuit on all the evidence, submit the charge, jury finds against the individual, jury, and now the judge is going to write down, and he's in the course of employment. The judge is going to write down the judgment, and the first thing he says in the judgment is, we find a judgment rendered against individual. Well now, does that mean then, is that just like situation number three, i.e. government, judgment against individual followed by judgment against government? Well, you could split the hair that much. If the concept means that, you could say that. But we believe the better concept is to say you don't want to encourage two lawsuits if you don't have to. And what happens if you don't take the concurrent, as we are asserting, as the Corpus Christi Court asserted, then you force two lawsuits. Lawyers got to sue the individual first. You've got to reduce the judgment. You've got to make sure statute of limitations doesn't run on him against the governmental entity. And then he proceeds against the governmental
entity.
You
could sue the governmental entity before there's a judgment. You just have to make sure that
it doesn't get the judgment.
That's right.
Yes.
You have to make sure you
exactly
put one
so.
Safe and slow the other one down.
Exactly so. Well, unless there's some pretty specific guidance by the court, you can imagine how that plays out in the trial courts of this state. Because you file a lawsuit against the individual and against the government, and then you, as plaintiff, say, Your Honor, I'd like to have a plea and abatement on my. You ask him to abate your own case against the governmental entity until you finish the suit against the individual.
It's not real good judicial economy, is it?
No, it's...
We consolidated two cases in here today because the same or similar facts and issues were involved, and when you've got a case where the same facts and issues are involved, it makes sense to try them together, doesn't it?
That is certainly our position, because otherwise, what do you do if the court won't abate it and proceeds in a rush to judgment on the
policy, it can't be our ultimate. I think we'd all agree it's better policy to try the same case one time, but that really can't be our ultimate determination. We've got to do what the legislature tells us to do.
I agree with that, Your Honor,
100%. If this language doesn't help us, and it doesn't help me too much, we kind of need to look at what else the legislature has done and try to get a hint on that.
I agree, Your Honor, but I think in interpreting the statute, you certainly want to be thinking about the practical results of what your interpretation is. I mean, let's face it, the legislature is apparently not going to answer this question. They did not answer it when the original Tort Claims Act was enacted. Governor Smith vetoed it, and one of the veto things he said was that bill exempts from personal liability for his own acts of negligence all employees of the state operating a motor vehicle. And he vetoed it for that reason. They took that out. So you still had your claim against the individual. And ever since that time, I believe every session of the legislature, I can't swear to that, but I know in the last session, bills have been introduced to make, in effect, the Tort Claims Act the exclusive remedy. That's what, as I understand it, Justice Doggett was focusing on. Those have not succeeded in our legislature. And I don't think this court is going to be willing, I may be wrong, but I don't think the court is going to be willing to change that law to say that's your exclusive remedy under the language of this statute. So if it's not your exclusive remedy, then it seems to me having the lawsuit happen at the same time is the best possible way to do it, and doesn't result in any harm if the individual is liable in a separate lawsuit. Why shouldn't he be liable in a concurrent lawsuit? It's just a question of hours, it seems to me, that they have let him out just before it goes to the jury, and it's okay. Well, Anyway, my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Are there any questions?
Thank you, Your
Honor. May it please the Court, Mr. Dennis Sanchez will present argument third.
May it please the Court. In response to the Court's inquiry as to whether Madisonville is dispositive of our particular case involving Candy Spinks, we believe it is. We submitted an independent ground of affirmance in both the appellate court as well as in our brief to this court, and that is that the issue was waived by the defendant, Dan Gibson. There was no pleading whatsoever at the time that this case went to trial invoking 101.106. The first time that that statute was raised in the trial court was on their motion for new trial. The trial court made a specific finding of fact at finding of fact number 96, transcript page 121, 122, stating that the defendant, Dan Gibson, did not raise the issue of waiver, raise the issue of 101.106. And they failed to raise it in the appellate court. They have also failed to brief it in the appellate court in this court. We asked the, as I stated, we raised that issue in the Corpus Christi court. It was not addressed.
In the appellate court, they failed to object to the trial court's finding of waiver.
That's correct.
But that's not really a factual finding. It's more a legal finding. Because what they said and when they said is not a dispute. It's whether or not that constituted
waiver,
preservation, and whether or not it was timely, which is a legal question.
Yes, sir.
And let's focus on the trial court situation.
So moving on to the Madisonville case. In Madisonville, that was the only pronouncement by this court that there can be joint and several liability, although the court does not mention 101.106. However, in the lower court, in an unpublished opinion, the appellate court there held that there has been a waiver because the defendant in that case failed to raise that issue as a defense prior to trial. And because of that, they, in the unpublished opinion, they found 101 and 106 has been waived. Then it goes up to your court, and you all, render joint several liability against the municipality as well as the individual. We didn't have the benefit of the unpublished opinion, so we're reading Madisonville, and it says joint and several liability. We also believe that Madisonville has been on the books since 1983. This issue's never been raised with this court before, and we believe that for judicial autonomy, that's probably the proper policy decision to give to 101.106, which is you've got to have judicial economy, you've got to read the statute in its common sense understanding. In all of the cases, and in the briefs, in all of the briefs, the defendants, in this case the municipalities, have failed to cite this court to the title of that statute.
Is the title?
In the title.
The title that written by the legislature, or was it written by the
I don't know, Your Honor.
I mean, I know the answer in revised civil statutes because this court has held the title's no evidence, but I don't know under the code if the legislature writes the code titles or not.
I don't know that, but I know under the Code Construction Act, you should look to the title. I believe the court is entitled to look to the title to glean some meaning. And the title
the
is...
The citation of the Code Construction Act?
The citation of that act is...
Well, for that particular part.
Is at section 311.023, parentheses 7. And the title is Employees Not Liable After Settlement or Judgment. And if you look at the word action, we believe that the word action should be interpreted to mean lawsuit, that you can't have a lawsuit after a lawsuit has been settled or a judgment rendered, that you can no longer have a subsequent lawsuit.
Can we go back and talk about the waiver for a minute?
Yes, sir.
From a technical standpoint, the individual did not know until after the judgment came in whether or not there was any need to rely on the statute. until you're hit for some money, and arguably until you're hit for more than the cap, right. Individual isn't really on the line for anything. And your counter-argument is it's not fair, because had it been raised pre-trial, you could have severed the cases or done something to try to avoid this problem. But do you know of any instance where this court, in the absence of legislative action, has applied that kind of fairness thing to say that you have to make objections in time for the opposing counsel to maximize its best trial strategy, rather than only make an objection at the time when it hits home?
No, I don't. But I think that the only way you can properly interpret Madisonville is to look what happened there. In that case, there was no plea to 101-106, and if 101-106 was applicable back in 1983, then this court either had to find and adopt the issue of waiver before the trial court, or they had to say, no, 101-106 does not prevent a simultaneous concurrent judgment, because you can't have it both ways. It could either be one way where you say there was a waiver, and therefore 101-106 isn't considered by the Supreme Court, or you have it the other way, where the Supreme Court has to say, whether or not there was a waiver, we still don't find 101-106. So I think it's incumbent on this court to determine what was meant back then when it came up at that time. It wasn't discussed in the Supreme Court action, but if the court had to impliedly find that there was a waiver, then you didn't need to talk about 101-106. And the other point that I would like to make is the case of Lalo. In the case of Lalo, there was a simultaneous lawsuit brought. The court, lower court, trial court, granted a summary judgment against the municipality or school district in that case, and then they subsequently booted out the school bus driver because they said 101-106 bars any subsequent lawsuit against this other individual. This court granted writ on that case, and again, we know that the court did not address it, but if the court were going to have addressed that issue, it would not have had to have gone to the education code in order to find the driver immune. This court could have simply said, we adopt 101-106 because that's the way it was in the trial court, in the appellate court, and that's the way it is here.
But sometimes we like to do things the hard way.
Maybe so. But and the other issue
I'm really, maybe you can't give me any help, and if you can't, that's fine, but we've been struggling with the idea of waiver and preservation, and you've probably read our multiple opinions in pain. And my question is more than just what we might or might not have done in a per curiam 11 years ago or could have done. When is it fair to require somebody under our rules to bring this point up?
Well,
and when should they be penalized, I guess, to the ultimate degree if they don't?
I think it's fair to the injured party to have this court require fair notice by the defense. You can't.
It wouldn't help the trial judge. I mean, to have this objection on the day the suit was brought, it isn't going to help the court at all. It's a help to the opposing party.
It is a help to the opposing party, and it's a help to the resolution of the lawsuit. But because if they do raise it, then you can plan your lawsuit out accordingly, determine who has proper insurance coverage, who does, who doesn't, and determine which way you want to go. But if you wait till the very end and say King's X and raise it on a motion for new trial, that gives an undue advantage to the defendant, I believe. I think that fair notice is what's required by this, has been required by this court in other instances, and to raise it at the last moment, after judgment is, after you irrevocably, if you assume their argument, have adopted and secured judgment, I think that really prejudices the party like ourselves. I think if this court is struggling because it is a fuzzy statute as they've discussed, if you try to adopt what does the common plain language mean, if you simply insert the words lawsuit, instead of the word action, that gives it all the plain meaning that that statute needs. There is no case on point, and we wish there were. Nobody would be here today.
You need the word subsequent in there, too.
Pardon me?
You need the word subsequent in there as well.
The word subsequent would be very helpful, yes.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Mr. Arnold Aguilar will present argument last.
May it please the court. My name is Arnold Aguilar of the firm of Willett and Aguilar in Brownsville, Texas. I'd like to thank you for letting me appear before you today. Let me submit to you, first of all, that the only issue before this court is the proper interpretation or application of Section 101.106. That is the only matter before the court, and I think basically there are four considerations the court has in trying to resolve that issue. The first one is a literal reading of 101.106. The second is prior case law. The third is the legislative history of 101.106, as Mr. Brandon tried bringing up. And the fourth is the plaintiff's right to sue the individual initially, followed by a suit against the entity. I would suggest that the proper way to resolve this issue, and I think the only way to consistently resolve all four of those considerations, is to accept that 101.106 is a benefit given to the individual as part of the compromise in the passing of the Tort Claims Act for the waiver of sovereign immunity to the entity. This was a benefit given to the individual. Whether he chooses to accept it, use it, or not, that is his choice, but it's a benefit given to him. Let me begin by trying to respond to the concerns raised by each of the justices. Initially, Justice Doggett was concerned about the possibility of an individual who is drunk, grossly negligent, and for whom he causes a serious death, and at that point is very responsible to the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. I would submit to you that if that is the case, it would easily fall within the dictates of Morreale, as this court set out. For an intentional tort, the Tort Claims Act would not apply. 101.057 would kick in, and at that point, the plaintiff could go entirely against the individual and get whatever relief he could from the individual, because that would be taken out of the Tort Claims Act. It specifically, 101.057 specifically exempts all claims for intentional torts. Secondly,
well, if it was found to be gross negligence, though not intentional, that would not be true, would it?
By this court's definition in Morreale, in order to be found grossly negligent, I don't think the court or any jury could find that an individual was not acting intentionally. With regard to Justice Phillips' concern about any authority for the writ of execution being an action, I don't know of any, and I don't know of any saying that it is or is not. There's also the concern about other claims such as a garnishment, an attachment action, execution on the judgment, or a turnover action, as well as any others that you could think of. The problem is those are terms that are not generally defined because there's generally no reason to. The specific language of the statute reads, a judgment in an action or a settlement of a claim under this chapter, bars any action, does not say just subsequent actions, does not say all but concurrent actions, bars all actions. And I think the language is clear that any action whatsoever, whether it's concurrent or subsequent, has to be barred. Now, I think counsel for plaintiffs in the trial court would all agree that a subsequent action would have to be barred. That's what all the case law shows. And as Chief Justice Phillips was clear in pointing out, in order to get past what they're requesting, you'd have to basically reverse all the decisions of the courts of appeal below, not simply in Gibson or Oldham, but in the various cases that have already been cited, including White v. Annis, Davis v. Mathis, Steele v. Barbian, Cox v. Clue, and a number of the others that perhaps I just don't know about. The problem is you have a situation where all subsequent actions are prohibited. All subsequent action against an individual is prohibited once you get the judgment against the entity. That part can't be disputed. With regard to their concern about the legislative history, I would ask the court again to look at the matters that were submitted to the court, because in regards to the legislative history, if you look at it, what happened was Governor Smith suggested certain changes between House Bill 117 and House Bill 456. In House Bill 117, he said, in his message regarding House Bill 117, what he said was, there's at this point, you can go entirely against the individual because the plaintiffs still have the right to do that. And he said, I would suggest leaving the law as it is. However, House Bill 456, which followed 117, House Bill 456 specifically said that, actually expanded on the protection given to the employee, because in House Bill 117, it only prohibited any further action after judgment. House Bill 456 said prohibited any further action after judgment or settlement. So what they were saying is we're disregarding that. Secondly, according to the interpretations of all the courts below, you can have a subsequent, once you have a judgment against the entity, you cannot have any further subsequent action against the entity. That would be clearly contrary to what they are arguing the governor's message should have meant. So with that, it's clear that what the legislature did was ignore the governor. The governor, of course, the executive, has nothing to do with the legislature intent. Legislature simply, as I explained earlier, intended to provide a level of immunity to the individual once the entity is found responsible. What they're saying is, basically what they're saying is, look, plaintiffs, we're going to let you go ahead and go after entities, which is something you could never before have done. But in exchange, if you do go after them, and if they do have the pocket, which most individual government employees do not have, if you are able to recover from them, get a judgment from them, or settle with them, you cannot do anything further against the individual. And that comes to the last point, that being, once you, what a number of plaintiffs want to do now is they want to file the action first against the individual, get either a settlement or a judgment, and then go after the entity. And the concern is the duplicative nature of the lawsuits. What you have basically is a plaintiff being sued in his individual capacity. Now, if a defendant is put in that position, an individual defendant, I would submit that what should happen is what the Court of Appeals in Gibson referred to is a mandatory joinder. At that point, the individual should say, you know, I was working for that governmental entity at the time, and I think they should be brought into this lawsuit. I think they should be brought in to resolve whether that entity was responsible. And before you find any judgment or settlement, before you find any judgment against me individually, you should resolve whether that entity was responsible, because I think they were. With that entity in, they can continue with the case, resolve the issue, and decide whether the entity was, in fact, responsible.
This is the policy. Limit. This is the policy. The policy is to limit the recovery of the injured party, not necessarily to limit the liability of the guilty parties. There's a statutory limit on the governmental entity's liability. But regardless of the injured party's damages, that's the limit. Regardless of how responsible the individual may be, that's the limit. The injured party is bound by the limit on the governmental entity, period. That's what you're saying.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if a trial court should do that.
Interest is served.
If a trial court should do that, how come there's these statutes about, in some instances, requiring entities to buy insurance policies? That just looks like an insurance relief act.
I believe you're referring to Chapter 102 of the Act. What they're saying is the entities are allowed to buy insurance on behalf of
them. I think for police officers, they're required.
I believe that's the one in the city of Houston. I'm not personally familiar with that one. But I think
thinking they could never be liable on that judgment if respondeat superior is caught.
What they're trying to do is say, if you choose to sue the individual instead of the entity, in that circumstance, we are going to provide coverage for the individual. Basically, that's the policy I think the city of Houston or whichever other city is doing. With regard to Justice Gamage's concerns, what I could respond, Your Honor, would be that basically what they're saying is, prior to the Tort Claims Act, there was no basis for recovery against the entity, and chances are there wasn't much basis for or possibility of recovery against the individual either, because prior to the Act, most individuals just simply did not have the deep pockets sought by the plaintiff, and there was nothing they could get from the entity. This was part of the compromise. It might not be the best of all possible worlds. Perhaps what the justice might suggest would instead open up immunity completely. However, that is not what the statute says. And what I'm trying to find is a consistent way to read the statute, read the case law, and read each of these concerns being raised by everybody. And I think that's the only way to logically do that. And that's why I'm suggesting this is the policy that essentially comes out of it. There's always benefits and drawbacks to every policy, but this is the only one that I see that can be most consistent.
Thank you.
that sums up my argument. I realize I speak very quickly, and I apologize for that, but I didn't know how much time or how quickly I'd be able to get through this with the question.
Well, I'm going to take your question. Given all the things that parties have to plead affirmatively and such under Rule 93 and Rule 94, why shouldn't an individual defendant who's planning on relying on this interpretation of this of 101.106 have to advise the plaintiff at least sometime prior to the verdict coming in that they tend to rely on this interpretation?
First of all, Your Honor, I did not brief that because that matter is not before the court. My understanding is that that was not one of the issues submitted to the court. If the court would like, I could submit a supplemental brief because I am aware of at least one other case which says that basically you don't raise a defense until there's a reason to raise the defense. Until the judgment is entered as against the entity, the individual does not have that as a defense. Until
well, if you have that case, I'd appreciate you.
I'll be sure to submit that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes the argument in all the causes on today's submission docket, and these causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
Thank you.